All right, so I was impressed yesterday how much we stayed on schedule the entire time. We have about 15 minutes. I think if we went a little over, it wouldn't be the end of the world, but I think we can have a nice, compact conversation. And what I'm trying to draw all these papers together as I was listening to them, and I did find there are several points of convergence, of course. So I'll speak to a couple of issues that I think we might have, that we might posit as a group topic, and then we'll open it up to some questions from the audience. But one of the themes that seemed to appear and reappear in your talks was your fascinating talks, and I learned a lot about the films by listening to you unpack them and point out elements that I hadn't noticed before, even though I've looked at all of these several times. So that was the general theme of presence versus detachment, say. I would say detachment rather than absence, because it has to do with a sort of physical presence, a visual presence, but something that withdraws, that sort of recedes from view or from our comprehension. Birger Predat spoke about the relative presence or visibility of organization, the very difficulty of actually capturing that on film. Christine Nobrinkmann spoke of the theme of distraction, especially in so much as you are directed, your eye, your attention is directed off camera frequently. I think there were other ways in which you spoke about presence, but I'll just mention that one. Wolfgang Bayernhof spoke about this interesting term, distanzierte Nähe, or a sort of distanced nearness, if I understood. I think I wrote it down correctly. Was that right? Jana Komfra spoke about this very interesting opposition between the writing of futility and the writing of presence. And Bernhard Ziegert spoke in the end about this idea of the coupling and decoupling of the hand and gesture, and then gradually the hand and the eye. And so I wonder if we could bring ourselves together a little bit around these questions of presence and absence, presence and detachment, which I think also play out in the process of watching these films, partly even on the level of the phenomenological experience of walking through the exhibition space where you're looking at one screen, but you're always aware of multiple others. And do you often walk into a film midway through? Do you step aside until it resets and watch it from the beginning? Do we watch something for 30 seconds or less and then move on to the next one? And so I would just open that up to the group. To what extent do we think that presence, or let's say the difficulty of capturing presence and experiencing a sense of presence, is overcome the extent to which the difficulty is presented by the films, and whether the films help us to overcome that process in any way.
It is, of course, a quite difficult question, because we are dealing with something like 400 films, and mm-hmm. they, of course, approach this in a vast variety of ways, and mm-hmm. but nevertheless, I think that is at least for rather large set of these small films true, that yeah. they in a way have to deal with that. And of course, I mean, I'm completely with you that we very often have this strange feeling that that we see so much what one could call archaic kind of labor. You know, it's really so often that this connection between the hand and the eye mm-hmm. is played out, mm-hmm. and the question of presence and absence between these tools. And my special interest, I started to get more and more involved in this question mm-hmm. when I started to think about what is the camera doing here, mm-hmm. and what is the definition of the camera. I mean, are these are these documentaries? Do they Do they document something? Or how much is the, what is the camera? Is it an eye? Is it in hand itself? And because in several cases, of course, the camera intervenes into these, into this play between absence and presence. Like, you know, these camera pans. So many of the filmmakers, since they aren't allowed to cut or to edit, they use the means of panning the camera. As kind of dramaturgical means. So so you have a close-up on the hand, and then you you go to the head, and you then you see whether the person is looking at it, at his or her hands or not. So but in this way, you know, if you're doing this and you show the hands, you count on the expectation of the spectator that the spectator at least imagines that there are somewhere eyes that watch what the hands are doing. And it's and all these cases are very irritating, as in Harun's essay, when it turns out that there are no eyes. You know, that you can't, that this connection is left open, or we just have no control over what at the other end of the channel is. Is there someone, the same person that is doing something, is this person watching?
But there's always an implied controlling agent, right?
And that is so this is why the camera is, I think, not in any case neutral or not involved in this.
So meaning the filmmakers themselves are not neutral. They're unpresent as part of the kind of discussion.
Professionell. Sie sehen sozusagen immer das ganze.
Well, they see the whole filming process. But I don't see that. For me, it's the world, not a camera, that's relevant. I found it very interesting that we're focusing on gestures, gazes, attitudes. They're important for me now because you say that. But I didn't identify all of that. I see social spaces and organizations. I don't see the staging so much. In the film that you introduced, the one that I didn't know before, with the Vietnamese lady standing by the barrier. It's a completely senseless form of work, really, if you ask me. And of course, there is a state corporation behind this. Cheap labor, people wearing uniform. We would have an electronic device to do that. So it's a labor world based on a military hierarchical civil servant structure, paying people to do idiotic jobs. I found that horrifying. I was born in 1950, and I know that. There used to be people standing at the railway barriers in the olden days in Germany, too, old men usually, disabled soldiers, veterans, with flags and so on. And they turned the railway barriers. So in a sense, it made sense, but it's a kind of work which doesn't really call for anything much except a certain degree of attention to signals. And there was a really strong impetus to get rid of that in the past. And I have a different gaze on this, I would say. And there's also the signal flag. Nobody mentioned that. That sort of confuses me, because it's not used, is it? Well, that's a security element. If, for example, if the barrier, the railway barrier weren't open, she could use the signal flag. Or perhaps maybe she needs to wave to the train to indicate perhaps there's a car that hasn't stopped. That's all the only thing that the flag is for. So it's potential sometimes to have a real function. Well, no, it does make sense. But, you know, why do you have to make things more difficult for this poor person?
It's roughly two-minute film. There's that narrative of there's that moment of presence appearing at the end. We finally understand what her function is. We kind of assume we know what's going on, but until you see her actually close the gate, then there's that moment of revealing presence through a certain function. And it reminded me of the film that Thomas Elsässer spoke about in the keynote, which was these musicians in the subway, where as the camera slowly pulls back, a certain presence is revealed that was in the off before that. And so there's a kind of continuity to the piece. It has a certain wholeness as a film, which then itself suggests a kind of presence that maybe isn't there in the larger context.
It's also in the film with the drawers.
Right, right.
Where you at first don't know what's going on, yeah. And you don't understand that he's closing the drawer all the time. Mm-hmm. Why?
And why keep opening and shutting it instead of just leaving it open until you're done?
Yeah, it would be much more practical, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
But I think that's partly the point. Of, you know, for me, the counterpoint, the important counterpoint is between a question of presence, which I would crudely, for now, associate with the eye, mm-hmm. and this business of disappearance that I would associate with the hands. Because interestingly enough, precisely because in the ones that I've really enjoyed, the one you just showed us and the one Subway, precisely because the attention is called to the hand, you realize just how not present these people are. Mm. You know, they are virtually disappearing in front of your eyes. I mean, people literally don't see this man.
Yeah.
He's almost not there. Mm-hmm. You know, they walk literally through him. Now, when you think about, let's say, Joan of Arc, let's take a classic on the face. I mean, she will disappear, and yet somehow there's a plenitude of the presence mm-hmm. because of this emphasis on the ability of the face to express a presence. Mm-hmm. Whereas with these characters, you're looking at their hands, and after the futility, you say, why do they do this? Well, they're doing this because they're dying literally in front mm-hmm. of your face. You know, it's utterly, utterly meaningless. Mm-hmm. And because it's meaningless, it means quite literally no life. Mm. It's bare life, you know?
Well, that also, though, because we really just focused on five films plus a couple of others that were brought in, there are films in the cycle that, in a way, do the opposite. Right. And there's the one in Argentina, in Buenos Aires, of the man who's steaming clothes. He's in a cleaner's. And the camera's actually, you don't really see his activity. It's kind of implied by the context, but the camera's focused on his face. And he's constantly making eye contact with the camera and then looking down to his activities. And so there's such a range of these relations set up by this whole cycle of films. Did you want to?
Vielleicht noch mal zur Präsenz.
Perhaps on the question of presence, because it's interesting to think about the kind of camera that is used, the kind of camera position, the kind of camera work. It's not a narrative or documentary camera showing and indicating details or portraying something step by step in a process. Camera unfurls a field in which something can be seen, and there's a real intensification of that. It's charged with some kind of energy. My consideration was whether there is such a thing as showing by means of a camera, not in terms of a zoom or a camera pan, but really by constructing or building up a field within which a person can move. Not leaving that field, and hence giving that individual a high degree of presence. Because if you think of it in terms of perception, it's not just about observing something that is alien, extraneous to you, but in an unexpected way, you feel linked to this person with this distanced proximity.
In terms, you laid out the framing of it within the temporal and spatial framing of the works. Mm-hmm. It keeps it compact and focused. Yeah. Maybe we can take a few questions from the audience at this point. Does anyone want to? I can see reasonably well. Alex? Yeah.
Yeah, You know, I want to return to this issue of the presence of labor, and it seems to me in watching so many of the films, including the five that we saw today, the disjuncture, the contradiction between the instrumentality of labor, which is the purpose of labor, and the breakdown of that instrumentality within right. so many of the films. I thought the closest that, what I'm trying to get at, the closest that any of you came to that would be the, maybe the notion of absurdity and tristesse. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a humorous element in a lot of, there were, people were laughing at the absurdity of some of these breakdowns. And it's interesting that in so many cases to represent labor today requires that kind of witticism, requires that kind of humor, underlying humor, the representation of the breakdown, as if that is the norm, which I don't believe it is. So in terms of the representation of labor, to come back to the presence of labor, why do you think it's so necessary to be witty in that representation? Is it because it's something that's going to be presented within the context of an art world? I'll leave that as a question.
Mm-hmm. I don't think it's intentionally witty. For me, it's partly what I was trying to draw attention to with the figure of Keaton. Yeah. You know, so you have this thing with most of the Keaton films where there's this unbelievably melancholic sense, infusion scenes, and as a consequence, somehow almost as a byproduct, I can hear myself, couldn't work out what was going on, as a byproduct of that, this comedy comes through. So I think the two are tied. The absurdity, the tristesse, and the comic are almost Cervantes-like, mm-hmm. bound with each other. It's not a deliberate thing. I don't think any of them are trying to be, you know, necessarily witty, quote unquote, if you see what I mean.
I think this is very, very convincing what you're saying. And I would just want to add one point. I think it has also to do, I mean, this feeling of wittiness or that is that we nearly laugh at some point or think or feel that it's kind of funny is, I think, it's also a lot to do with what I was trying to point out, namely that in many cases, these people who are doing something or fulfilling some kind of purpose are not in command of the situation. I mean, there's much more the objects around them, the whole setting, which is in command of, as you pointed out, and what we cannot see, all the organization and the dispositives of power behind them. And that is what your comparison with Buster Keaton makes, at least in my mind, makes it so convincing, because it's exactly that what this yes. this melancholy yes. of this constant, or this, yeah. this wittiness of constant failure, mm-hmm. is because Keaton is completely ausgeliefert. He's among his objects. Yeah. Think of The Navigator, for instance. I mean, which is a Heideggerian study of constant, confrontation with non-functioning objects. You know, all the objects are too big, or they do different things. Or, you know, so you're kind of machinic part of an operational chain that is doing something, and you're just part, like this woman on this in this Vietnamese film. She's standing there at this gate, but she is not in control of the situation. She is controlled by the train, by the motorcycles, and of course the state who had put her there. And that is, of course, the reason why it needs to be funny. You know?
But I think one of the reasons Keaton works, and maybe coming back to your question a little bit, is What I see in Keaton that connects with a lot of the films is that they don't imply a moment of superiority from the perspective of the viewer vis-a-vis the person performing labor. If humor sometimes sets up that kind of relationship, a relationship of non-equals, I think one could look across the whole series and find a whole spectrum of ways in which wit humor might function in terms of setting up those kinds of distinctions. But I think in many of the films, it's more in the way, along the lines of what Keaton was able to do, which was to create a certain empathy through humor. Yes. There's a question there.
Yeah, I really enjoyed the panel and especially the readings of the films. My question, where I felt a little bit frustrated perhaps, is given the two-minute format, the reduction to the gesture of hands, what happens, I mean, and this would get back to the first speaker, why is this labor being performed for whom? We only really see that, I would say, in the film that people didn't really deal with that much about the drawer, right? So you see it's a service industry. He's performing a service at the end, which is interesting because it was the most fictional of the films. But I found myself wondering, okay, so there is a difference. We've mentioned the fact that the laborers in China and in Vietnam are working for the state. But what is the case in Johannesburg? All we know, it's Johannesburg. There's certain implications there in that country of South Africa where we're seeing black laborers. The conditions are also different in Mexico. Who are these children? What is their class background? So I found myself wondering, how does class, how does race, ethnicity play out, or does it become then completely dropped out of a discussion?
Anyone want to?
Ja, ich nehme einen Aspekt mal auf.
I'd like to pick up on one aspect that I find especially interesting. We see work in different cultures here. And we don't know, or at least I don't know, how Vietnamese or Chinese attitudes to work are represented in the people that we see. It might be that this figure that we view as a rather sad figure in the underground relates to a very particular way of depicting labor in China. And I also found interesting there were these officials, for example, in Vietnam and China, they were working on a senseless task, but with this full authority of the state railways behind them. And they exuded authority to those around them. But that's something I don't see directly, in a sense, in the image. Their kind of performance is one I find interesting. I wonder what kind of cultural appraisals of labor they help to convey. There's, for example, the woman checking the trouser. She's got an enormous degree of competence. And I think she's slightly different from the other. She's, in a sense, showing them how it really works. But I don't know whether that's something that you just see in this film or something that's taken on board in her mode of cultural working. For example, in Germany, craftsmen had this real strong sense of pride. They were self-confident. That's something I think is missing here. Of course, this is just a selection. And something else that strikes me as well is the cultural differentiation and the diversity, the way in which there's a particular stance on how things might be interpreted differently by the people involved and by us. There's the question of whether we're reading something into the text, whether we're seeing something or not. We can only really talk about seeing what we see, what we can observe.
Probably break.
Yes, very fascinating panel. Just to come back to the point about why is it humorous, why is it comic? I was wondering whether there isn't kind of a very fine line between scenes that are comic and at the same time tragic. It's a kind of, and I think the reason is that any discrepancy of purpose and result or intention and effect is either comic or tragic. So you know, while the underground guard may seem comic, the boy seems more tragic. So that the futility aspect of so many of them raises this issue of whether we perceive them as comic or as tragic. But coming back to what John Comfort was saying about the ontology of film, when I was watching the Underground Guard, I immediately thought of it as a metaphor of cinema, because it's a kind of défilé. It's a kind of, you know, every person is like a frame passing through the gate. And what you then have is a very interesting dialogue between editing a montage and the long take. In other words, the guard stands for montage, but the people are for the long take. So it has a kind of meta-cinematic dimension that I rather enjoyed. But my question was really at Wolfgang, I think, because I was struck by both the nimble fingers and by the Wood's operational tools that, you know, both of them had a control function, but which is a kind of secondary one, but both regained a certain agency, not by the separation of hand and eye, but the bringing in of the body. I think the nimble fingers is, she's a nimble body. I mean, she's dancing to her own rhythm. And that element I didn't see quite recovered in your presentation, that, you know, her whole body performs, and the guy with the operating tools, who is also actually a control function, because his purpose is to clean the table. He's not selecting, he's simply controlling that which is on the table is actually also what's on the sheet. And how he gains agency in this control function is the kind of theatrical gesture with which he picks the scissors and so on.
Ja, vielleicht beim letzten.
Perhaps I could pick up on the last point, Thomas. What I found so interesting, and what I thought so much shaped this entire sequence, is what you could perhaps call a process of ordering. There's the question of the gestures and the gestural program that has to come into play here for it to be actually functional, and for order to be generated. With the seamstress in the tailor's workshop, the gestural dimension seems to become entirely autonomous. You can say that it's delinked or uncoupled. You could almost imagine a machine doing this, but then the body would no longer be present. And this dissociation, and at the same time, the mise-en-scène of the relationship between the body and the process is very striking.
I mean, just one remark, yeah. It's nothing to do with, I think, with what Thomas Elsässer just asked, but what I find so striking in this example, Surgical Instruments, is that is the only film that we had of all that we saw where we know, after we have grasped the idea, what the guy is doing, that is the only film where we know when it will be finished. Yes. Because we see the instruments, and we know after the last instrument went to the basket, the film will be over. So all the other films had an open end. You don't know how, of course you know it's 2 minutes, but as we learned, 2 minutes can be very long and very short. So the whole time economy of that film is completely different than the time economy of the others, because we can see, we can even feel how the time is going on and is approaching, and the film is approaching towards its sense, like in these little GIFs that you have on your computer when you can see how much time you need until the download is completed. You know, you see really like this kind of download is in 5 seconds, 4 seconds, 3 seconds. You know, that
it stands on
how many different. Films can almost be understood in genre terms or shot terms, or, you know, I mean, that film
is one of those trick shots that doesn't work the second time. Mm. You know, yeah. Once you've seen it once, yeah. you're just sitting there yes. waiting for
yes.
to collect it. Yeah. You know, it doesn't work as a sequence. Mm. It's interesting. Yeah.
No.
Ich würde gerne noch hinzufügen.
Let me add two. In Nimble Fingers, the whole thing starts again. The film doesn't end once she's finished. The next thing comes around, the same thing comes around once again. That's a slight change as well, because we realize that it's a repetitive process, not just a one-off.
Actions. We have to repeat the panel time three more times today. And so in deference to the upcoming panels, I think we'll have to cut it off. But I want to thank all the panelists and thank you for your attention and questions.
Thank you.